Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source. My question for one of Ukraine's leading novelists, Andrei Kurkov, is what Ukrainians are going through in what is called the Ukraine crisis, but has so few Ukrainian voices coming out of it. In Russia's alienated brother nation, they've been waiting for most of a month for Vladimir Putin's guns. But are they heard yet in the talks to lift the Russian siege? Do they see a way out for themselves, for a world on edge? Andrei Kurkov is just outside Kiev, a popular writer of many books, an independent thinker. You write in Russian, Andrei. Sounds like you think and feel in Ukrainian. What would we be picking up this week with your friends and neighbors? These Ukrainians we don't know well enough.
It's much easier to talk about difference in mentalities between Russians and Ukrainians and maybe Poles than only about Ukrainians. But generally, Ukrainians are Eastern Europeans, and if you meet one in the street, you might mistake him for a Pole, for Czech, for Slovak, even sometimes for Croatian guy. But I mean, the ladies are beautiful, the men are strong, and love singing, and love food, and love drinking. And actually, it's a very joyous and very noisy nation. Not as noisy as Italians, but almost. What is very important for Ukrainians is the freedom and personal space. And actually, Ukrainians respect freedom, including freedom of speech, much more than Russians.
If you were talking to a stranger, how long would it take you to figure out you must be Ukrainian?
Well, it depends on the question you put. I mean, if you ask a stranger who Crimea belongs to, and he says Ukraine, it means he's either Ukrainian or pro-Ukrainian. Or European.
What is Ukrainian humor? You deal in it.
Well, Ukrainian humor is partially abstract, partially very physical, but also intellectual. And I mean, it comes from a mixture of Jewish humor and political Soviet humor, because Ukraine actually was a huge place for hundreds probably of Jewish villages and shtetl in small towns. Mm. And the Jewish culture was very important and strong in Ukraine.
So interesting, because you have a Jewish president whose life work was comedy.
Yes, although I should say that I don't like his humor.
Tell us about it.
Well, I mean, do you like Benny Hill? Maybe you don't know Benny Hill, a British comedian. I mean, for me, President Zelensky is the representative of Benny Hill humor, but also of some political humor of not very high quality.
What is Ukrainian fear? What is Ukrainian dread in your writing, but also in this crisis?
Well, I mean, the word independence means too much for Ukrainians. Personal independence and the independence of their country, because they understand that actually they are free. And they are independent only while their country is independent. And I should explain that actually the historical matrix on which Ukrainian mentality is based is anarchy. I mean, European anarchy was born in Ukraine. The borders were unfixed. They were moving left and right. But at the same time, legal system was working, and there were elections of Hetman, and Hetman was at the same time like Tsar, and the military leader. Hmm. We had elections here from 15th, 16th century.
Andrei Kurkov, speak about what Ukrainians are going through, specifically in these last 30 years since the fall of the Soviet Union, and how things have changed. They have not done as well economically, even in terms of political stability, maybe, as the Russians proper. What's been happening?
Well, it's difficult to say in a few words, but I mean, this anarchy that I mentioned is part of the reason, if not the main reason, why Ukraine didn't succeed so well economically. But at the same time, every other family succeeded. So, I mean, the Ukrainians are usually building paradise in their families, in their houses, not in the country. And only minority of active political Ukrainians are trying sort of to persuade the rest to do the best for the country. And actually, Ukrainians unite when the danger comes for their country. I mean, they united in 2014-15. They united in 2004 during Orange Revolution, and I'm sure they will unite also in case of all-out war with Russia.
Say more about what the last 30 years have done to the Ukrainian head.
Well, I mean, they became much more self-confident than they were before. They became less post-Soviet. I mean, the inertia, of course, of Soviet mentality, collective Soviet mentality is still there, but it doesn't play such a big role now. And generally, I mean, Ukrainians are very good entrepreneurs. They are taking risks in business. They are traveling a lot and with joy. They are working abroad and sending money back home. And we can talk about 1 million, more than 1 million of Ukrainians working in Poland, replacing 1 million of Poles which are working in Britain, etc.
No kidding. Plumbers too, probably.
Yeah. They are very flexible and they're hardworking. And now when actually you can do what you want, I mean, lots of people are building up their small empires, business empires. They are building small hotels in the Carpathian Mountains. They are becoming farmers, so they want actually to be financially independent. Mm-hmm. And usually, I mean, they have to fight against, of course, corruption of civil servants, of different clerks, of local authorities. And, I mean, this problem remains. I mean, the corruption remains one of the biggest problems in Ukraine. But still, I mean, there are always attempts to fight it, and I hope in the end, actually, Ukraine will overcome this problem.
Vladimir Putin speaks of Ukraine and Russia as brother countries. A very ambiguous point. But he also says Ukraine is not a sovereign nation. It's a leftover nation, and Russia got part of it. Make what you can of the history of Ukraine in people's heads.
Well, I mean, Ukraine is older than Russia, and Kyiv actually is 1,550 or 70 years old. And it was built several hundreds years before Moscow was founded. I understand Putin's nostalgia and actually fear to be left alone without real history of Kyiv's Rus. This is one of the main reasons why he is talking about brotherhood and that Ukraine should belong or belongs to Russia. I mean, Russia could belong to Ukraine if Ukraine was of Russian size, but actually Ukrainians want to be independent, and actually they always wanted to be independent because in 1918 there was another attempt to create independent Ukraine. At that time, actually, with the help of Germany after the end of the First World War, it failed because again Russian Red Army came and took Ukraine over. So probably there is some kind of inferiority complex that Russia is afraid of. To be left without Ukraine, for them just to be left like without a liver or without a leg.
Somebody wrote that. Maybe it was Adam Tooze or Tim Snyder, but the thought that the insecure person, the insecure identity in this crisis is Putin and Russia.
I agree. I agree completely because, I mean, the desire to restore Soviet Union comes from this complex. I mean, Putin has everything, but he thinks that actually Soviet Union was much more important as well as Russian Empire. And Russian Federation today, left without its republics, the territories that it controlled, doesn't play such a big role in the world politics. The attempt to reclaim these ex-Soviet territories are sometimes successful attempts like with Belarus. They show his desire is actually also geopolitical, not only historically based.
Do you believe that Putin is genuinely afraid of what NATO could do? This is the man. Russia is a country, of course. Napoleon invaded. Hitler invaded. Is that a genuine fear of Europe coming after Russia still?
No. I'm sure they are not stupid and they understand that actually NATO is not going to attack Russia. NATO is actually about the collective defense of the European countries and the United States. So it's not an aggressive bloc. But of course, for Russian people, the propaganda which was distributed for years and years in the Soviet times still works. I mean, the image of NATO as the evil dog of the capitalist West is still in the heads of ordinary Russians, and they easily believe that NATO is after their happy country and their happy lives.
Would Ukrainians consent to being declared neutral between East and West, like Austria and Vienna in the 50s during the Cold War, will declare Ukraine off limits to this kind of contention?
You know, Vienna, when it was off limits, it became, I would say, the most popular place for spies from all around the world. Yeah. I would not like Ukraine to become such a place. And of course, I mean, neutral Ukraine would mean for Russia that it is Russian Ukraine or pro-Russian Ukraine. That would definitely happen. It would be close to Russia, and Russia would try to make it anti-West.
Could Ukrainians live with that?
I mean, some people would live with this, but I mean, young people probably would leave the country, and active people would fight against it if there are means to fight against it in such a situation.
Andrei Korkov, you are a leader of PEN, the writers' union, so to speak, in Ukraine, in a country that takes its writers seriously. I'm just discovering the 19th century poet Shevchenko, a hero still among many Ukrainians. Speak of the writers in your world and of a kind of, it sounds like, cultural renaissance, even in the last 30 years.
Well, I mean, Ukrainian new literature is very young, and the writers are quite young, and they are very active and politicized. And they are also volunteers in the frontline regions. And actually, even today, one of the cult poets in Ukraine, Sergei Jadan, is accompanying British soldiers in the frontline zone, probably just that arrived to train Ukrainian soldiers. Generally, I mean, the audience for the young writers are, of course, young Ukrainians, not old Ukrainians. And for the young Ukrainians, literature, contemporary literature, means a lot. And it also means, actually, politics.
Coming up, Andrei Korkov is just getting warm. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The Ukrainian novelist Andrei Korkov has lots more to say on what's wrong with Russia beyond the border war. It's about books and borscht and, of course, Putin, the man.
Well, I mean, the Ukrainian literature used to be apolitical until 2004. It was romantic, it was poetic, it was about beautiful nature and life in the countryside. And since then, actually, a lot of things changed. And now literature is also about fighting disinformation and fighting Russian propaganda and actually telling the truth about Ukrainian history. And this history was banned in the Soviet times. I mean, people couldn't talk openly about Holodomor, about artificial famine that was twice organized in Ukraine by Stalin and his people. People didn't talk about deportations of hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian farmers to Siberia. Now it is all there, and it is all in literature.
When you write imaginative fiction, who's your audience? Where are you trying to connect with them?
Well, I'm not young, so my audience is older. And these are people actually of middle class who remember still Soviet life, because, I mean, some of my novels are set in the Soviet times and in the years immediately after independence. So my audience is older, and I can see during book launches and during book presentations that I have in different cities and towns in Ukraine.
How do you describe what you're trying to serve to your readers today?
Well, actually, I always thought that my purpose is to provoke readers to learn how to judge situation, how to analyze what is happening, and to find their own attitude towards things around them in politics, in life.
You write in Russian. What does that mean?
Well, this is my mother tongue. This is mother tongue for millions and millions of Ukrainians. I speak Ukrainian without actually an accent, but in my fiction, in my novels, I remain with the Russian language because I grew up with it, and I was actually born in Russia, although I grew up in Ukraine. It doesn't mean that actually I have problems. My books are published in Russian, but they are also published in Ukrainian translation.
Do Russians read your books?
No, in Russia, my books are not available.
Wow.
Used to be published, but the first time they were banned in 2004 during Orange Revolution. Then they were reprinted briefly, and then they stopped publishing them, and they banned my Ukrainian publishers from bringing them to Russia to sell. I'm not welcome there.
How would Russian censors know that, no, we don't like this?
I think the first reason to dislike my books were not actually the books itself, but my interviews and my articles in international press about Russian politics towards Ukraine.
What is it you say that they can't stand?
Well, that I don't like Putin, and I don't like this attempt to expand Russian-Soviet collective mentality on Ukrainian territory. And I wanted them to respect Ukraine as independent country and not to try to create some kind of artificial pro-Russian politicians and to finance them in order for them to become more popular.
Let me just say, there was a very long article in the New York Times yesterday, Sunday magazine, about two soldiers in particular in the Donbas fighting. And as somebody says, I mean, it's an almost medieval scene. It could be 1943. Could be 100 or 1,000 years ago.
Well, I mean, you should imagine that we are talking about 450 kilometers front line and official ceasefire, which is broken every day dozens of times. And every day there are shellings on different parts of this front line. And if the war begins, the front line will have length of 3,000 kilometers. I mean, Ukraine has probably about 40,000 soldiers which are trying to cover these 450 kilometers. Oh. And it does mean that there are places where there are no soldiers and people still live there. People are trying to survive with no, sometimes electricity, no gas, no shops, no infrastructure.
What is the cause of this forever war, we could say? And what is the cure for it?
Well, the cause is the desire of Russia to reinstate its importance in the world and to restore the Soviet or pre-Soviet empire. And the cure, it's difficult to say because, the cure can be only pressure from the world forces. But world forces are divided because, Russia was trying hard to divide member countries of European Union, and they succeeded with Germany because, Germany is opposing the sanctions now. Germany doesn't want to sanction Nord Stream pipe, gas pipeline, etc. But generally, without this pressure, Russia will try to take over, if not all of Ukraine, then half of Ukraine, and then maybe half of Moldova, and Baltic states are in danger. They are small, and actually even a NATO general said that actually a Russian army can take over Estonia or Latvia less than in a day.
Are Ukrainian people depressed in this situation, or are they simply hoping to get through it, that it won't touch them?
Well, there is no panic, that's for sure. There was panic and fear in 2014 when Russian parliament voted to allow a Russian army to act on foreign territories. Now people just wait and check the news and wait to see what is happening. And some people are waiting in a very active way because, we have now a territorial army. And a lot of people volunteer to go and to train in territorial army and in order to defend their villages or towns in case of the war. So there is no mass immigration. People are still living on planes to go for holidays to Egypt or Maldives or Dominican Republic. And my friends just came from the weekend trip to Berlin. So, I mean, it looks like everything is still the same, but there is tension in the air, and there is a demand of more news and more detailed news. And it's very interesting that actually we have more frightening reports from USA and from Britain than from Ukrainian mass media.
I have to say, Andrei, I'm chagrined by how few Ukrainians I know and how little sense I have of that country. What would you like us to know and do about what Ukrainians are going through?
You can find a lot of Twitter accounts in English written by Ukrainians. But I mean, the main thing is to remember that Ukraine is a big country. It has the same size as France. It has all kinds of landscapes, including mountains in the west and southwest. I mean, Ukraine has 40 million people who speak many languages, not only Ukrainian. It's very multicultural and very lively society. And actually, it's a society which wants to be free and, of course, wants to enjoy life. Because, I mean, the Mediterranean attitude towards life is very important for Ukrainians. I mean, day starts with a very good cup of coffee, the Italian way. You can find Ukrainian books in translations. You can find Ukrainian films and even Ukrainian music. Last week in London Barbican, there was a concert of Dacha Bracha, a very interesting band from Ukraine. And I mean, the concert was sold out. So it shows that we have our audience. Ukrainian music has its audience.
What's the Ukrainian voice that we should be discovering here?
There is a big choice. I mean, you can even discover Ukrainian voice in Ukrainian restaurants or on YouTube in videos how to cook borscht, the national Ukrainian beetroot soup.
Yes.
Which has lots of recipes. And actually now UNESCO is considering to register it as a non-material cultural value product of Ukraine.
I don't know. Could you tell the difference between Russian and Ukrainian borscht?
Well, there is no such a thing as Russian borscht.
That's the spirit.
Russian national soup is called shchi. It's a soup made of marinated cabbage. It's a nice thing, especially in the winter. I mean, there is a Polish borscht, but it's pronounced barsch, and it's a bit different. But Ukrainian borscht actually is made with beetroot, cabbage, meat, beans, chili pepper, if you like spicy things. And there are probably hundreds of recipes because, I mean, I cook it myself. And actually, it takes time. It takes about 2 hours to cook a proper borscht, but then you are rewarded with the taste that is unforgettable. And a glass of good Ukrainian vodka will help you actually to check and to feel the quality of the soup.
I want to hear more Ukrainian voice in these negotiations, maybe yours, but I think the resolution might be just to let everybody leave, NATO and Russia, and let the Ukrainians spend a great day with their borscht.
That would be great. That would be great. And I'm sure that would be celebrated also in the streets.
Andrei Korkov, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Andrei Korkov's newest book on the Amazon list is a surreal fantasy about a depressed writer who adopts a penguin from the Kiev Zoo. I tell Richard Lurie he's our favorite American eavesdropper in the Russia zone. He was the translator and then biographer of the great physicist and dissident Andrei Sakharov in Brezhnev time. And then Richard had the nerve to write an autobiography of Stalin. He also wrote a book 2 years ago titled Putin, His Downfall and Russia's Coming Crash. I asked Richard Lurie, what's driving Putin's moment on the border of Ukraine?
Well, talk about eavesdropping. One thing I hear in the sort of historical ether is a happy birthday to you, Mr. Putin, because Putin will be turning 70 years old come this fall. And I think that has to be affecting a lot of what he's doing these days, including, number one, trying to determine his place in Russian history. And, you know, Russian leaders are very aware of their place in Russian history. Stalin used to read biographies of Ivan the Terrible and annotated them furiously. That's the true audience, or one of the true audiences they're playing to. And I think what he's done now, he wrote an essay, everyone's talked about this, Putin has wrote an essay last July called On the Historical Unity of Russians and Ukrainians. And, you know, we notice that it's never a Ukrainian writing these essays. It's always a Russian saying, you're our brothers.
Yes, and as the brothers.
The president of Russia jokingly put it, yes, we're brothers, like Cain and Abel are brothers. So I think Putin is being driven by three things right now: his advancing age and his need to define his place in Russian history. If he brings Ukraine back into the fold, so to speak, he'll be major. If he doesn't do something of that order, he'll be like Brezhnev, a guy who ruled for a long time, but in the end, it was stable to the point of stagnant, and in the end, is of no historical prominence. The other thing is, he didn't play the COVID situation very well. He didn't appear in public. There were no shots of him with his shirt off getting a jab. It was known that you had to quarantine for 10 days to see him and then walk through this long chemical spraying tunnel to get to him. The phrase Navalny slapped on him, and he's very good at doing that, was the geezer in the bunker. The latest numbers on Russian COVID deaths make it number two in the world after India. The number's around 929,000, what they call excess deaths, deaths that ordinarily, statistically, wouldn't have happened. So he's got a situation at home where he's looking weak. He can't control the COVID situation. He's turning 70, and he has this opportunity, let's call it, on the Ukrainian border to do something of major importance, at least as he sees it. He's the opposite of the Godfather. He's presented America with offers that we can only refuse. And then ultimately, he'll go into Ukraine, I would predict, by the end of February.
Wow. Speak, while we're thinking of Sakharov, of the dissident problem that Putin has in Russia today. Navalny in prison. There are those who say dissidents and the stability of his own regime is a much bigger hazard for Putin today than anything represented by Ukraine. Could this all be a distraction?
It is a distraction in the sense that it's the only way that he can reinvigorate his power and image in Russia, because Navalny successfully challenged him both by returning to Russia when it was absolutely clear that he would be imprisoned, and so far standing up to prison very well, which will increase his stature enormously when he gets out in 2 years, if he gets out in 2 years. The one thing that Putin did that really sort of shocked and surprised me was he essentially closed down Memorial, which was the organization that Sakharov and others started to keep track and enshrine the memory of all the people who died in the Gulag. In those days, Putin himself was sympathetic to Sakharov and admitted that the Soviet regime had treated him too harshly for someone who had given them something as valuable as the H-bomb. So I consider it an especially severe sin for him to close down Memorial, because even though it was to some degree dealt with human rights issues that are happening in the present, it was the Gulag, it was Sakharov. And if you're going to trash that, to me it's a sign that you've entered a dangerous phase.
Why were you forecasting Putin's downfall and Russia's collapse?
I still do, because in 2008, the price of a barrel of oil was about $150, and Russia was awash in money. The middle class was burgeoning, and everything was fine and dandy. Everybody loved Putin. That was the moment when he had the chance to switch Russia from a gas and oil economy to a high-tech economy, to use all that fantastic brain power that Russia always has. They could have leapt ahead in the world by leaps and bounds, but instead he chose, for one reason or another, to invade Georgia. The invasion of Georgia revealed what poor shape the old ex-Soviet army was in, and so all that money that could have gone into R&D and business and nanotechnology and a million things like that went into guns, basically, weapons. That was Putin's great chance to become a major figure, and he sort of vaguely knows it too. And now he has another chance. By taking Ukraine back into the fold, he can achieve stature and prominence, whether it's negative or positive in a sense, doesn't even matter to him. He lost his chance. And so that means that Russia is, in 10 years or so, Russia is going to be less and less able to make it as a energy superpower. And that's going to lead to both Putin's demise or downfall and Russia's crash, because they'll have nothing else. They'll have weapons and wheat.
We're trying to see it from the Ukrainian side. Do you want to decode that relationship that Putin has characterized as the brothers? The notion that Ukraine was never and isn't today a full nation. It's an annex of Russia.
It's a county, not a country. That's how the Russians, or some Russians, see it. And that's what Putin meant when he said to Bush at one of their get-togethers, I think also in 2008, it's not a real country, George, he said to him. It's interesting. The Russians can see it that way, but you don't hear many Ukrainians who make a kind of mythological ideology out of the brotherhood of those two peoples. You know, if I were Ukrainian, what I would say to the Russians is, great, that's a wonderful idea. Brotherhood of Ukrainians and Russians. Let's start a brand new Slavic brotherhood, and let's have its capital in Kiev for a change instead of Moscow. And then let's see how brotherly the Russians would react to that. If you look at a map of Ukraine, which I've been looking at lately, and it sort of worries me, it's split down the middle by a big river. The eastern half is the more Russian-speaking side. The western half is the more Ukrainian-speaking side. And Kiev, the capital, is very near the Russian border. If he goes in now, after all this, and just takes a little piece of eastern Ukraine, a little bigger piece, so that maybe he can supply Crimea directly by land, that'll look sort of cheesy and punko. If he goes in, he has to take Kiev.
Coming up, more from Richard Lurie on what the immortal writers in Ukraine, as well as Russia, mean to the living today. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The Boston-born writer Richard Lurie made his name translating Russians. He says we would miss the heart of Ukraine and of Russia if we miss the weight of their heroic writers still speaking to the present day.
I'll say one thing about the Ukrainians. You know, the Russians are very funny about poetry. This is where poetry intersects with geopolitics. Lavrov, we don't know much about this guy, the foreign minister, but there's two things we know about Lavrov. One is he smokes cigars, and two is he writes poetry. And the thing is, to the Russians, language and poetry have an importance that's much greater than it is for us. The first big square after Red Square in Moscow is Pushkin Square, and the next square is Mayakovsky Square, another poet. To them, poets are extremely important. And you're a country to them, this is on an intuitive, emotional level, if you have a great poet, if you have your own Shakespeare or your own Pushkin. So the Russians have Pushkin. The thing is, and this is bad for the Russian myth, is the Ukrainians have the equal. It's a guy named Taras Shevchenko, and he's about the same time, late 18th, early 19th century. He was exiled into Russia, deep into the interior of Russia, for being a bit of a dissident in his own time. But he wanted a Ukraine that was free and independent, and why not? You know, the 300-year experience with Russia wasn't good.
The Ukrainians can also claim Gogol. And in the modern time, Isaac Babel.
That's right. And as someone pointed out, even the president of Ukraine, not only is he Jewish, but he's Russian-speaking. So a lot of these old-time categories really don't fit modern realities anymore. Ukraine wants to be, for the most part, you know, they elected their president in a free and democratic election, and he was running against the incumbent,
right,
as Timothy Snyder points out.
Right. They unelected presidents, which Russia has never done.
Yeah, that's right. So Ukraine needs to be an independent state. But the truth of the matter is that George Kennan, who was the ambassador to the Soviet Union and the inventor of the containment theory, said he was very against the eastward expansion of NATO. He said it will only make the Russians paranoid, militaristic, and nationalistic. And he was right. So the problem is, what do you do about Ukraine? And the thing is, I don't believe that Putin is worried about Ukraine joining NATO, because he can keep Ukraine out of NATO easy as pie. All he has to do is keep stirring up trouble at the border, because NATO doesn't take countries that have border issues or frozen conflicts. All he has to do is keep that going, as he's done for the last 8 years, at relatively low cost. It isn't a question so much keeping Ukraine out of NATO. It's getting Ukraine back in to the Russian orbit. And if anybody reads that long essay that Putin wrote, his vision is not of a revived Soviet Union, but a kind of Slavic superstate with Belarus, Ukraine, and Russia, you know, Slavic brothers together, drinking vodka and going to the bathhouse and ho, ho, ho.
Richard, I'm glad you mentioned George Kennan, father of containment and all that, an opponent of moving NATO east after the unification of Germany. George H.W. Bush seemed to have been ambiguous or maybe deceptive on that point. There was the line, NATO will not move one inch to the east, but in fact, we did. In what sense is the United States a player and maybe a provocateur in this whole crisis?
Well, there's three things there. One is, definitely Baker said that to Gorby, and Gorby still complains about it. Although, you know, you can also say, in the immortal words of Samuel Goldwyn, that a verbal agreement isn't worth the paper it's written on.
Right.
But Gorby should have gotten that on paper. That's one thing. The other thing is, it doesn't really matter who said what when. NATO did move, and it moved, if you look at a map, it moved, you know, right up into Russia's face, all the way from the Baltic Sea way in the north to the Black Sea way in the south. It's a big arc of NATO, and if you get Georgia and Ukraine into NATO, then they'll have the whole of the Black Sea. Those are very hostile moves. You don't outflank a paranoid. You don't do those kinds of things. You have the right to do them, but there's going to be consequences, and we're seeing those consequences now. Obviously, all those countries have suffered for hundreds of years under Russian rule. Take Poland, for example. And, of course, they wanted to be in NATO as protection against a resurgent Russia, which they all knew would happen sooner or later. 10, 20 years, Russia would be back, and it would be Russia. It wouldn't be, you know, Sweden. It would be like Russia always was, and they were right in that respect. And so they were smart to scurry it under NATO's umbrella. But number one, some of those countries didn't turn out to be so wonderfully democratic like Hungary and Poland. And number two, it's raised Russia's hackles to the point where they feel justified in doing what they're doing right now. So one question is, you know, where do we go from here? How do we get out of this mess?
My suggestion would be amplify the Ukrainian voice, the Ukrainian interest in this whole deal, not NATO or a test of Joe Biden or the intentions of Putin. But the Ukrainian people, how to do that?
Well, you know, the thing is, if they can build a strong, vibrant, relatively uncorrupt society, which is what, of course, Putin is, in a kind of a way, the most afraid of. He's the most afraid of free people like Navalny and Ukraine. They're alike in that sense, is that they challenge the very principles of his existence, the very idea by which he lives, which is that the world is a power game, and anybody who pretends otherwise is either naive or hypocritical. And so here come people who say, no, the world is better than that. We can make a decent life, and we don't have to oppress others, and there's enough to go around, and we can choose our own leaders, and we're grown up enough to not to go to war over stupid things. That's the real threat to him. I'm for Marshall Plan aid to their society rather than sending them these anti-tank weapons, which are good in the geopolitical game, but Russians got a lot of tanks. We can't send those things in fast enough. Plus, you got to train the guys how to use this technology so you don't start shooting airplanes out of the sky. You know, I'm against putting all these troops into Poland. Now, you can do it. It's part of the game. It's showing you're not weak. But my real belief is that if you want to threaten Russia, say to them, look, we can supply Europe with gas, not gasoline, but natural gas. We can supply Europe with natural gas. That threat or that reality could be very sobering for Mr. Putin, because a huge amount of Russia's income comes exactly from gas and oil, which is the reason they're in trouble. And this could be his downfall, and sooner than we think.
Who's your favorite Ukrainian? Real, imagined, living or dead? Cultural, political, anything?
Well, I do love that poet, Taras Shevchenko. It's an interesting story. He was a serf. He was owned by somebody, Shevchenko. And his owners noticed, and friends of his owners noticed, that he was an amazingly talented man. He would pick up a piece of chalk or charcoal or a piece of anything, and he'd start drawing on the ground with it, and he'd make beautiful pictures. And then it turned out that he also wrote excellent poetry, and 10 of his admirers got together and purchased his freedom, and it turned out to be the price of 10 overcoats. He eventually fell foul of the Russian authorities and was sentenced to exile deep in Russia, but came back and played his role and was very much both a symbol of what Ukraine could be. He went from being a Russian slave to a brilliant poet and artist, and ultimately a martyr to his nation. And so I like him because he shows the latent potential of a people who, if given half a break, could surprise the hell out of themselves and the rest of the world.
That's a wonderful story. I'm in search now of your man, Shevchenko. Richard Lurie, thank you so much.
Well, we've been talking together for years, and it's still a pleasure.
Richard Lurie is a lifelong student of Russian letters and life. He composed his own fictional autobiography of Stalin. And finally, a very connected news and opinion columnist in London with a distillation of the Western European view of the Ukraine crisis. Gideon Rachman writes for the Financial Times, I asked him whether Vladimir Putin knows quite what he is doing.
Well, it depends what you mean by whether he knows what he's doing. I think he's a brilliant tactician in the sense that he's brilliant at discomforting the West. Everybody is kind of scrambling around to think about what the appropriate response is, how to deter him and so on. So in that sense, I think you could argue that in this particular crisis, he has the initiative. What I don't really see is the broader strategy to, in the very long term, bring Ukraine back into a Russian sphere of influence, which is what this is all about. I think he may, through invasion, be able to topple the current pro-Western government in Kiev and put a pro-Russian government in place. But, you know, looking at the medium to long term, it seems to me that if, as a Russian nationalist, you believe that the division between Russia and Ukraine is artificial, some kind of historical aberration, well, there couldn't be a better way of stoking Ukrainian nationalism than for Moscow to overthrow the government in Ukraine. Now, they may be able to control Ukraine by force for some time, but in the long run, I think that they kind of ensure that Ukraine and Russia will have separate identities in the future.
Yeah, everything he's done since Crimea in 2014 is part of what's driving Ukraine out of the Russian sphere of influence.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Russians would point out, with some fairness, that Ukraine is not, you know, a culturally unified country. It is the case that there are many Russian speakers in the East who look to Moscow as much as they look to Kiev, and that's why there's been this dispute that the Russians have intervened in so ruthlessly. But nonetheless, I think that for those people who might have been sitting on the fence, the fact that Russia has essentially stoked a war in Ukraine that's already, we shouldn't forget, cost 14,000 lives since 2014,
right.
You know, has to be something that's hardly likely to endear the Putin regime to them. So I think that, yeah, historically, this is a kind of, will eventually be a big rupture between Russia and Ukraine. And there are, you know, now in the, with war so close, I think dissenting voices in Moscow are struggling to make themselves heard. But, you know, there are pro-Russian voices. Say, Dmitry Trenin is a well-respected academic in the Kremlin who, as recently as a few months ago, was writing, look, if we really want to rebuild ties with Ukraine, we should be doing this through business, through culture, through education, not through military threats. But that doesn't seem to be the route that Putin is taking.
My worry this week would be that Ukrainians, who will pay the price of the war, are not being consulted in avoiding it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that one of the things that makes people feel very uncomfortable is the echo of the 1930s, that, you know, if you remember when Czechoslovakia was dismembered, the Czechs were not at the table in the Munich talks. And people didn't like the image of Biden administration people talking to Putin government people without Ukrainians there. Similarly at NATO, the Ukrainians were not there, nor they were at the OSCE talks. But generally, it feels like this is a diplomatic process taking place over the Ukrainians' heads. Now, of course, the White House says repeatedly, we're moving in lockstep with the Ukrainians, we consult them at every step. But sure, the optics aren't good.
And meantime, NATO is the player far removed from each of those preoccupying political crises in the Western states. How do the Europeans feel about their NATO warriors these days?
Well, it will vary country by country and political party by political party. But broadly, I think you could say that the further east you get, the keener they are on NATO. So that if you're the Baltic states, if you're Poland, Romania, Bulgaria, you regard NATO, and behind that, the United States, frankly, which accounts for something like 70% of the military spending of NATO, as the only real guarantee or hope you have for security. The Europeans do not spend enough and are not united enough to provide a convincing alternative security guarantee to the one offered by NATO. And I think the other thing is that, you know, there's also knowledge that in France, in Germany, there is a history of ambivalence towards NATO. France, for a while, opted out of the political structures of NATO. As recently as 2019, President Macron gave an interview in which he said NATO was brain dead because he wants to see the European Union being essentially providing the security without relying so much on the US. And maybe that would be a good idea. But they are so far from doing that, that if you're really feeling you're on the front line, you have no option but to rely on NATO.
So what's the chance of Europeans waking up after their local elections and political crises to discover that NATO has gotten them into a war?
I mean, I think they would say Russia's gotten them into a war, but I don't think, unless things get really out of hand, and they can in a political crisis of this sort, that you're going to see NATO clashing directly with Russia. What may happen is that Russia attacks Ukraine, and then Ukraine attempts to fight back with a lot of weaponry supplied by NATO countries. But one of the reasons that Russia has the upper hand at this precise moment in the crisis is because the Americans and NATO have said, we're not going to fight in Ukraine. Ukraine is not a NATO member. We will support them politically. We may provide military aid, but we won't fight. So I don't think there's a very strong chance that, you know, Germans, French, Brits are going to wake up, you know, in a few weeks' time and said, oh, my God, we're at war with Russia. There is a slim outside chance, though, which is that once you get an escalating military crisis, NATO is sending more troops to Eastern Europe, things can get out of hand. People lose their tempers, people miscalculate. So there could be an accidental clash, but it would be an accident. No one's planning on it.
Gideon, I'm intrigued that Tim Snyder, the historian, very hawkish about, or wary, shall we say, about Putin's Russia and the autocratic trend of our times, takes a very different sort of line in his latest piece. He says we should be negotiating, obviously, but even more, broader negotiations are called for on the premise that something is simply wrong in the European security system. NATO, as Macron says, is maybe senescent. Donald Trump says he'd undo it if he ever got back in. Who in Europe is thinking about modern security realities? A different Russia, a different Europe.
You know, I have friends who I take seriously who believe that we should take Russia's concerns seriously, that it is a great power, that it has legitimate concerns about its security outlook, and that, you know, it used to be until, you know, both of our lifetimes that Russian security bloc went all the way into Berlin, and then they lost the Warsaw Pact, and then they lost half the Soviet Union. And now they're saying, well, you know, for goodness sake, we can't allow, for example, the American Navy to do port visits to Odessa or Sevastopol or whatever. That all sounds fine, you know, in theory. The difficulty is that, it's very hard to trust Putin per se when he makes those arguments, because this is a guy who, you know, if I take my own country, there's something like several Russians have been murdered on the soil of Britain. You know, this is a guy who sends out assassins around the world who we know lies. For example, when that airliner was shot down over Ukraine, the Malaysian airliner, killing hundreds of people, almost certainly with a Russian supplied missile. It was a long inquiry in the Netherlands about what happened. That was their conclusion. But the Russians just never admitted to it. They didn't say, we made a mistake, we apologize. They just lied about it. And similarly with Crimea, they said there are no Russian troops there. Then very much later, they said, oh, actually, there were. It's one thing to say, taken as a sort of, as an abstraction, the Russian state has legitimate interests here. I would agree with that. But the Russian state that is represented by Vladimir Putin is pretty close to a gangster state. And that makes it really hard to say, okay, we're going to sit down and have a rational discussion, because you can never really, I think, trust their word.
Gideon Rachman, thank you. It's always a pleasure to read you and hear you.
Thank you for having me on.
Thanks also to Andrei Kurkov, author of Death and the Penguin, and Richard Lurie, author of The Autobiography of Joseph Stalin. Please think of supporting the hardest working team in radio. You can leave a tip at radioopensource.org or by becoming a monthly subscriber on Patreon, where you will find a growing audio library of conversations on all sorts of subjects. Find it at patreon.com/radioopensource. Our show this week was produced by Mary McGrath and Adam Coleman, with engineering help from the WBUR production team. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source. Open Source is a proud member of Hub and Spoke, a nonprofit collective of smart, independent podcasts. This week, we want to let you know about Making Meaning, a limited series from the Hub and Spoke show, Ministry of Ideas. Hear experts from psychology to philosophy to religious studies explore the poetics and possibilities of meaning in the modern age. You can find the whole series at ministryofideas.org/meaning. And we hope you'll check out the whole lineup of Hub and Spoke shows at hubspokeaudio.org.